As for his domestic affairs concerning his sons, whatever came of his own judgment, he managed with great shrewdness, since he never failed to prevail over those he judged his enemies. Though to my mind, he was in this respect a most unfortunate man. Before the king's death became known, Salome and Alexas sent away those who had been shut up in the hippodrome, each to his own affairs, telling them that the king ordered them to go off to their farms and manage their own property. And by this, they did the nation the greatest service. When the king's death was at last made public, Salome and Alexas gathered the soldiers into the amphitheater at Jericho, and first read out a letter written to the soldiers thanking them for their loyalty and goodwill toward him, and urging them to show the same steadfast support to his son Archelaus, whom he had appointed king. Next Ptolemy, who had been entrusted with the king's signet, read out the will, which was not to take legal effect until Caesar had examined it. At once there was a shout acclaiming Archelaus king, and the soldiers, company by company, together with their officers, promised him their loyalty and zeal, and called on God to be his helper. After this, they prepared the king's burial, Archelaus being anxious that his father's funeral procession should be of the utmost splendor, and he brought forth every ornament to accompany the corpse. The body was carried upon a golden bier studded with precious stones of many colors. The coverlet was of purple, and the corpse itself was clothed in purple robes and adorned with a diadem, over which lay a golden crown, and a scepter rested by the right hand. Around the bier walked his sons and the multitude of his kinsmen, and after them the soldiers, arranged by their national units or designations. First the guards, then the Thracian contingent, then all the Germans, and after them the Gauls, all in full battle array. Behind these followed the whole army, marching out as if to war, led by their captains and company commanders. Following them came 500 of the household servants carrying spices. They went to Hierodium, a distance of 8 stadia, for it was there, by his own command, that he was buried. Such was the manner of Herod's death. Archelaus, for 7 days, continued to observe mourning for his father, that being the number the custom of the country prescribes. Then, having given the people a feast and ended the mourning, he went up to the temple. There were shouts of acclaim and praise wherever he passed, each group vying with the others to make its acclamations seem the grandest. Mounting a high platform that had been built for him and taking his seat on a golden throne, he greeted the crowds in turn, receiving their goodwill with evident delight, and thanked them, saying that he bore them no grudge for whatever wrongs his father had done them, and that he would strive to repay their zeal without stinting. For the present, however, he said he would refrain from taking the title of king, for he would be honored with that dignity only once Caesar had confirmed the will his father had drawn up. That was also why, when the army at Jericho had been eager to set the diadem on his head, he had declined to accept that coveted honor, since the one properly empowered to bestow it had not yet made himself known. If matters turned out in his favor, he said, he would not fall short in virtue in repaying their goodwill, for in everything he would strive to show himself better toward them in every way than his father had been. The crowd, as a crowd is wont to do, supposing that the first days revealed the true intentions of those entering upon such offices, the more mildly and courteously Archelaus spoke to them, the more extravagant their praises became, and they proceeded to make requests for favors. Some cried out for relief from the annual taxes they paid, others for the release of the prisoners who had been bound by Herod, of whom there were many, and some who had been so for a long time. Still others demanded the abolition of the duties levied harshly on sales and purchases. Archelaus in no way opposed them, being eager, in his zeal, to please the crowds in everything, since he reckoned that winning the people's goodwill would greatly help him secure his rule. After this, he sacrificed to God and turned to feasting with his friends. Meanwhile, some of the Jews, moved by a desire for revolution, gathered to mourn Matthias, and those put to death with him by Herod, men who had at once been deprived, out of fear of Herod, of the honor of being mourned, these being the men condemned for pulling down the golden eagle. Raising a great outcry and lamentation, and thinking to gain some relief for the dead, they hurled reproaches at the king. When they had assembled together, they demanded that Archelaus punish those whom Herod had honored, and above all and most conspicuously, that he depose the man Herod had made high priest and choose in his place, a man more lawfully qualified and pure to hold the high priesthood. Archelaus, though deeply displeased by this, restrained his anger toward them because of the journey to Rome he had before him, which he needed to undertake quickly to look after the matters awaiting Caesar's decision. He sent his general to try persuasion, urging them to abandon such folly and consider that the deaths of their friends had come about under the law, that their demands were rapidly heading toward outrage, and that the present circumstances were not suited to such matters. Rather, this was a time for harmony, until, once he had settled his rule with Caesar's approval, he should return to them. For then he would deliberate jointly with them about whatever they thought right, but for now they should hold back, lest they appear to be fomenting sedition. Having said this and instructed the general accordingly, Archelaus sent him out to them. But they, shouting, would not let him speak, and put both him and any others who might, for the sake of restraint and to turn them from such aims, dare to speak in danger of being killed, since they were resolved to yield to their own desire rather than to the authority of those set over them. Thinking it monstrous that while Herod lived they had been deprived of their dearest ones, and now that he was dead they were denied vengeance for what had been done to them, their tempers inflamed. And holding whatever was likely to bring them satisfaction to be both lawful and just, while being too ignorant to foresee the danger it entailed. And if anyone warned them of it, the immediate pleasure of avenging themselves on those they took to be their worst enemies overrode all caution. Many were sent by Archelaus to reason with them, both men presently in office under him and others who, though seeming to come on their own judgment, in fact came at his direction in order to bring them to a gentler mood, but they would not tolerate hearing a word from anyone. There was an uprising, fueled by anger, and it was clear they intended to swell the sedition still further as the crowd streamed in to join them. Now, at this time, the festival was at hand at which it is customary for the Jews to set out unleavened bread. They call the festival Passover, since it is a memorial of their departure from Egypt, and they sacrifice it eagerly, with a greater number of victims than at any other festival, as their custom requires. Countless throngs come down from the countryside, and by now from beyond the borders as well, to worship God, and the agitators, mourning for Judas and Matthias, their expounders of the law, gathered in the temple, being well supplied with food for the rebels, since it was not thought shameful for them to beg it. Archelaus, fearing that some terrible outcome might grow out of their desperation, sent a cohort of soldiers under a tribune to check their impulse, before the whole crowd was carried further into their madness, and to bring before him any who stood out conspicuously above the rest in their zeal for rebellion. At this, the agitators among the expounders and the crowd were roused to still greater fury, shouting and calling to one another, and rushed upon the soldiers, surrounding them and stoning most of them to death. Only a few, along with the tribune, escaped, wounded. Once they had done this, they turned again to their sacrifice, as though their hands were clean. Archelaus, thinking it impossible to preserve order in any way without crushing this impulse of the crowd, sent out his whole army, ordering part of it to prevent those camped nearby from going to the aid of the men at the temple, and part to receive those driven out by the infantry, once they were confident of having reached safety. The cavalry killed as many as 3,000 men. The rest made their way off to the nearby hills. Archelaus proclaimed that all should return to their homes, and they departed, abandoning the festival, in fear of a still greater disaster, bold as they were only through lack of discipline. Archelaus then went down to the coast together with his mother, taking with him Nicolaus, Ptolemy, and Tola among his friends, and leaving Philip his brother in charge of managing everything in the household and the government. Salome, Herod's sister, also went out with him, bringing her own children, and many of his kinsmen went too, ostensibly to support Archelaus in securing the kingdom, but in reality to work against him, and above all to bring accusations against him for what had happened at the temple. Sabinus, Caesar's procurator of affairs in Syria, who had set out for Judea to safeguard Herod's property, met Archelaus at Caesarea. But Varus, arriving on the scene, restrained him from his intended course, for he had come at Archelaus's summons, through Ptolemy. To oblige Varus, Sabinus neither took possession of the strongholds in Judea nor sealed up the treasuries, but allowed Archelaus to keep them until Caesar should decide something concerning them, and he remained at Caesarea, having given this undertaking. But once Archelaus had sailed for Rome and Varus had gone on to Antioch, Sabinus made his way to Jerusalem and took possession of the palace. Summoning the garrison commanders and all who were in charge of affairs, he made it clear that he intended to demand an account from them and to install the strongholds as he saw fit. The guards, however, did not treat Archelaus's instructions lightly, but held firm, preserving everything as they had been ordered, their pretense to Caesar being that they were merely guarding it all. At this same time, Antipas, another son of Herod, was also sailing for Rome to press his own claim. Antipas too, Herod's son, was sailing to Rome at this same time, roused by Salome's promises to contend for the throne, and reckoning it far more just that he, not Archelaus, should take over the government, since by the earlier will he had been declared king, and that will, he held, was more secure than the one substituted for it. He brought with him his mother, and Ptolemy, Nicolaus's brother, who had been Herod's most honored friend and remained devoted to him. But the man who most spurred him on to contest the kingdom was Irenaeus the orator, a man trusted with the kingdom's cause because of his reputed cleverness. For this reason, he would not yield to those who urged him to give way to Archelaus, as the elder brother and the one named king in the later will by their father. When he reached Rome, all his kinsmen went over to his side, not out of goodwill toward him, but out of hatred for Archelaus. What they wanted above all was freedom, to be placed under a Roman governor. But failing that, they judged Antipas the lesser evil compared with Archelaus, and so they worked with Antipas for the kingship. Sabinus meanwhile sent letters to Caesar accusing Archelaus. And when Archelaus in turn had sent letters to Caesar setting out his claims, together with his father's will and the accounts of Herod's money brought by Ptolemy along with the royal seal, Caesar waited to see what would come of it. Once he had read these documents, as well as the letters of Varus and Sabinus concerning the sums of money and the annual revenue, and all that Antipas had written seeking to secure the kingdom for himself, he called his friends together to deliberate, among them Gaius, the son of Agrippa, and of his own daughter Julia, whom he had adopted and now seated first, and he bade those who wished to speak on the matters at hand do so. Antipater, Salome's son, spoke first, a most formidable speaker and the bitterest opponent of Archelaus. He said that Archelaus's talk of kingship was mere pretense, since in fact he had already exercised its power before Caesar had granted him anything, charging him with the outrages committed against those who died at the festival. Even if those men had been guilty of some wrong, the punishment belonged properly to those with authority to use it against outsiders, not to a private man. For if a king had done it, he would still be doing wrong by using Caesar's own prerogative of judgment before it had been granted him. And if a mere commoner had done it, the offense was far worse, since it was not fitting for one merely laying claim to a kingdom to have been allowed such license, seeing that he was thereby stripping Caesar of the very authority over such matters. He attacked him too over the removal of certain officers in the army, over his taking a seat on the royal throne, over settling lawsuits as though he were already king, over granting the petitions of public suitors, and over managing everything, none of which, he said, could possibly be imagined as done by a man merely appointed by Caesar to his position. He also credited him with releasing the prisoners from the Hippodrome, and with much else, some of it true and some merely plausible, since it is natural for such things to be believed of young men who seize power out of ambition to rule, and of the neglect of mourning for a father, and revels held the very night of his death, circumstances which, he said, gave the populace their first occasion to riot. Since it was outrageous that a father who had done him such benefits and thought him worthy of so much should be repaid for his corpse in such a fashion, pretending to weep by day like an actor on a stage, while by night he indulged in all the pleasure that power could give. And Archelaus, he said, would show himself the same before Caesar in seeking to be granted the kingdom as he had shown himself toward his father, dancing and singing as if an enemy had fallen, not a kinsman who had raised him to such benefits. Worst of all, he declared, was that Archelaus now came before Caesar to seek confirmation of a kingship, all of whose privileges he had already arranged for himself beforehand, treating as already secured what ought only to be exercised, once the emperor himself had firmly granted it. Above all, he made much of the slaughter at the temple and its impiety. How, with the festival underway, and while the sacrificial victims were being slain in the customary manner, some strangers and some natives alike were cut down, and the temple filled with corpses, not by some foreign hand, but by the very man who, even while pursuing the kingship under lawful pretexts, sought thereby to satisfy that injustice hated by all men which is the nature of tyranny. For this reason, he said, not even in a dream should the succession to the kingdom by right of his father come to him. For he knew the man's character, and indeed a more formidable enemy than himself had been set against him by the terms of the will, Antipater, for he had been summoned by his father to the kingship, not while his father was diseased in mind as well as body, but while he still used sound judgment, and while bodily strength still governed his affairs. And if the father had earlier disposed of things toward him just as he had now, it would show plainly what kind of king he would prove. One who, while Caesar alone held the right to bestow the kingdom and had been robbed of the power to grant it, was nevertheless, while still a private citizen, cutting down his fellow citizens in the temple without restraint. Having said such things, and having supported his charges with the testimony of many of the kinsmen, Antipater ceased speaking. Then Nicolaus rose on behalf of Archelaus, and said that what had happened in the temple should be attributed to the intent of those who suffered rather than to any authority exercised by Archelaus. For men in command in such matters are guilty of wrongdoing not only when they themselves commit outrage, but also when they compel those inclined to act reasonably to resort to self-defense. And that the men in question had acted as if in open war, ostensibly against Archelaus, but in reality, it was plain, against Caesar himself. For those who came as restrainers of the outrage, or who were sent by Archelaus and were attacked and killed while giving no thought to God or to the law of the festival, of these men Antipater was not ashamed to make himself the avenger, out of service to his own hatred for Archelaus rather than from any natural love of justice. It was those who came forward, and not those minded to do injustice, who were the rulers. It was the ones who used force, and forced those unwilling to defend themselves to take up arms, who were truly at fault. He laid the rest of the blame likewise on all those in council with the accusers, for nothing had been done that was not accompanied by their own approval, and thus the charge of wrongdoing applied to them. Not that these acts were by nature evil in themselves, but that they seemed likely to damage Archelaus. So great, he said, was their eagerness to insult a man who was their kinsman, the son of a benefactor father, and one who had always dealt with them familiarly and as a fellow citizen. As for the will, it had been written by a king in full possession of his senses, and it took precedence over the earlier one, since the judgment on what was written in it had been left to Caesar, master of all things. And Caesar would in no way imitate their insolence. Men who, having in every way enjoyed the benefits of Herod's power while he lived, now rushed with insulting intent against his memory, though not even they themselves had behaved so toward their kinsmen. Surely Caesar, he said, would not overturn a will made in good faith toward a man who had done everything for him and was his friend and ally, nor imitate their wickedness. Caesar, whose virtue and good faith toward the whole world stood beyond all doubt, nor condemn as madness and derangement of judgment the act of a king who had left the succession to a worthy son and had thrown himself upon Caesar's own good faith. Nor had Herod ever erred in his judgment of a successor, since he had always acted with sound judgment and left everything to Caesar's own decision. With these words, Nicolaus concluded his speech. Then Caesar raised up Archelaus, who had fallen at his knees, kindly, saying that he was most worthy of the kingdom, and he made it clear by many signs that his own inclination was to do nothing other than what the will prescribed, and what would be advantageous to Archelaus. Nothing, however, was yet confirmed, as if Caesar wished to keep Archelaus, even with so favorable a precedent to rely on, still without full assurance. And once the men had been dismissed, he considered by himself whether the kingdom should be confirmed to Archelaus, or whether it should instead be divided among all of Herod's family, especially since all of them stood in need of much support. But before any decision on these matters had been reached, Malthace, Archelaus's mother, died of illness, and letters arrived from Varus, governor of Syria, reporting the revolt of the Jews. For after Archelaus's departure, the whole nation had fallen into turmoil. Verus himself, once he arrived, inflicted punishment on those responsible for the disturbance and checked much of the unrest, then withdrew to Antioch, leaving one legion of his army at Jerusalem to hold the Jews' revolutionary spirit in check. This, however, accomplished nothing toward putting an end to their rebelliousness. For once Verus had departed and Sabinus, Caesar's procurator, remained behind, he pressed hard upon the rebels, trusting in the troops left to him and confident that he would prevail through their numbers. He armed many of the men and used them as his bodyguard, driving the Jews on and provoking them to revolt. For he was determined to seize the fortresses by force and eagerly pursued a search for the royal treasures, driven by greed for profit and lust for gain. When Pentecost arrived, a festival of hours so named by ancestral custom, the people gathered not only in observance of the rite, but also in anger at the outrage and drunken insolence of Sabinus. Tens of thousands assembled, a great many of them Galileans and Idumeans, and there was a multitude from Jericho and from those who dwell across the Jordan. And the Jews of the region itself gathered in numbers to join with all the rest, and were even more eager than the others to take vengeance on Sabinus. Dividing into three companies, they encamped in as many places. Some occupied the hippodrome. Of the remaining two groups, some turned toward the northern side of the temple facing south, while others held the eastern quarter. The third group held the western side, where the palace also stood. All of this was directed toward besieging the Romans, who found themselves shut in on every side. Sabinus, fearing both their numbers and the temper of men who thought little of dying rather than yield, since they judged victory itself to be the very measure of courage, at once sent letters to Verus, urging him, as was his custom, to come to his aid with all speed, since the greatest danger surrounded the army left behind, for he expected it would not be long before they were cut down and taken. He himself, meanwhile, seized the highest of the towers of the fortress, called Phasael in honor of Herod's brother Phasael, who had been so named after his own death at the hands of the Parthians. And from there, he urged the Romans to go out against the Jews, though he himself did not dare to go down even among his own friends, judging it right that others should die before him for the sake of his own greed. When the Romans dared to sally out, a fierce battle broke out, and the Romans got the better of it in many engagements. Yet the courage of the Jews did not fail at the sight of the danger, even though many of them had fallen. Circling around, they went up to the porticos that ran along the outer wall of the temple enclosure, and since the fighting there was hard to press home, they hurled stones, some flung by hand, others slung, being practiced athletes in this kind of fighting. All the archers, too, drawn up in formation, did great harm to the Romans, since they held the higher ground and were thus hard to attack, being beyond the reach of those who tried to cast javelins at them, while they themselves could more easily overcome their enemies. The battle continued in this fashion for a long time. Then the Romans, exasperated by what was being done to them, set fire to the porticos, catching unawares those of the Jews who had climbed up onto them. The fire, fed by many hands and joined by those skilled in kindling flame, quickly caught the roofing. Since the woodwork was coated with pitch and wax, and further overlaid with gold, the flame ran through it at once, and those great and most remarkable works were destroyed. A sudden and unexpected death overtook the men above the porticos. Some were carried down together with the collapsing roof, while others were struck down all around by the enemy as they stood. Many, in their desperation for safety and terror at the calamity surrounding them, threw themselves into the fire, while others used their own swords to make an end of themselves. Those who tried to escape downward by the way they had climbed up were all killed by the Romans as they emerged, naked as they were and broken in spirit, since desperation, lacking arms, could offer no help. Of those who had gone up onto the roof, not a single one survived. The Romans, forcing their way through wherever the fire allowed, seized control of the treasury, where the sacred funds were kept. Much of it was stolen away by the soldiers, but Sabinus openly kept back for himself 400 talents. The Jews were grieved by the loss of their friends who had fallen in this battle, and grieved too at the plundering of the votive offerings. Yet the most warlike and closely bound portion of them, gathering around the palace, threatened to set fire to it and kill everyone inside unless they departed at once, promising safety to those who obeyed and to Sabinus along with them. And most of the royal troops deserted to their side. But Rufus and Gratus, who commanded 3,000 of the most warlike men in Herod's army, men vigorous in body, went over to the Romans. There was also a body of cavalry under Rufus's command, which likewise became an addition to the Roman force. The Jews, for their part, did not neglect the siege, but undermined the walls and called upon those who had changed sides not to obstruct their recovery, in due time, of the ancestral freedom that was theirs by right. Sabinus, then, was glad enough to depart with his soldiers, yet he could not trust the offer, both because of what had already happened and because the very reasonableness of the enemy's terms made him suspect some trap intended to turn him from the course he had settled on. And at the same time, expecting Verus to arrive, he held out under the siege. Meanwhile, countless other disturbances took hold of Judea, as many men in many places, driven by hopes of private gain and by hatred of the Jews, rushed into war. 2,000 of those who had once served under Herod and had already been disbanded banded together within Judea itself and made war on the royalists, opposed by Achabus, Herod's cousin, who had been pushed back from the plains into the highlands through his familiarity with military experience gave the men, while the ruggedness of the terrain let him save whatever could be saved. Judas was the son of Ezekias, the archbandit who had once grown very powerful before Herod captured him only after great effort. This Judas now gathered a band of desperate men around Sepphoris in Galilee, made a raid on the royal palace, seized whatever weapons were stored there, armed his followers with them, and carried off whatever money he found there. He became a terror to everyone, seizing and dragging off those he came across, driven by ambition for greater power and by envy of royal honor, not through any proven excellence, but expecting to win that prize through the sheer scope of his outrages. There was also Simon, a slave of King Herod, but otherwise a handsome man who stood out for the size and strength of his body, and who had been given great trust. Puffed up by the confusion of the times, he had the audacity to put on a diadem, and when a crowd rallied to him, he too was proclaimed king by their madness, thinking himself worthy above anyone else. He set fire to the palace at Jericho and plundered whatever was stored inside it, and he burned many other royal residences throughout the country, destroying them, while he allowed his followers to carry off whatever was left as booty. He would have done something still greater had swift retaliation not followed. Gratus, commander of the royal soldiers who had joined the Romans, met Simon with the force he had, and after a long and fierce battle, most of the Pereans, being undisciplined and fighting with boldness rather than skill, were destroyed. And as Simon himself was trying to save himself through a ravine, Gratus overtook him and cut off his head. The palace at Amathus on the Jordan was likewise burned by another band of men like Simon. So great was the folly that took hold of the nation, because it had no king of its own blood to restrain the masses through virtue, while the foreigners who came in to set the people right became instead the very kindling of sedition, through their own arrogance and greed. Then there was also Athrongius, a man distinguished neither by the fame of his ancestors nor by any abundance of wealth or virtue, but a shepherd, unknown to all in every respect, except that he was conspicuous for the size of his body and the strength of his hands. He had the audacity to set his mind on kingship, thinking that in gaining it he would enjoy it more than the cost of dying for it, counting the loss of his life for such a prize as no great matter. He had four brothers, likewise big men and themselves trusted for their bodily prowess, who were thought to be pillars supporting his hold on the kingdom, and each commanded a company of his own, for a great crowd gathered to them. They acted as generals and served under him whenever they went into battle at his direction, while he, wearing the diadem, held councils on what was to be done and kept everything referred to his own judgment. This man's power lasted a long time. He was called king and was never deprived of doing whatever he wished, and he and his brothers were devoted to killing on a great scale, waging war on Romans and royal troops alike out of hatred for both. This on account of the arrogance they had suffered under Herod's rule, that on account of what they now thought the Romans were doing wrong to them at present. As time went on, they grew ever more savage in the same way, and no one could escape falling into their hands, some through hope of gain, others through sheer habit of killing. They once attacked a Roman company near Emmaus that was bringing grain and weapons to the army. Surrounding them, they shot down with javelins Arius the centurion, who commanded the whole party, and 40 of the best foot soldiers with him. The rest, terrified by their fate, found protection when Gratus arrived with the royal troops around him and escaped, leaving their dead behind. Carrying on warfare of this kind for a long time, they caused the Romans no small trouble and did great harm to the nation. In time, each of them was overcome, one falling to Gratus, another to Ptolemy. And when the eldest was taken, the last brother, grieved by his fate and seeing that safety was becoming ever harder to find because he was now alone and worn down by great hardship, stripped of his forces, surrendered himself to Archelaus on a pledge of good faith and by the trust of God. But this happened later. Judea was full of bands of robbers, and whoever the king in power happened to find joining any such rising, he pursued to destruction of the common good, causing the Romans little trouble in a few small matters, but bringing about a very great deal of bloodshed among their own people. As soon as Verus first learned of what Sabinus had done, from a letter Sabinus had written to him, he grew alarmed for the legion and took the two remaining legions, for there were only 3 in all in Syria, along with 4 squadrons of cavalry and whatever auxiliary troops the kings and tetrarchs of the time supplied, and hurried to help those then under siege in Judea. Orders were given for all who had been sent ahead to hurry to Ptolemais. The people of Berytus, as he passed through their city, also gave him 1,500 auxiliaries, and Aretas of Petra, seeking the friendship of the Romans out of hatred for Herod, sent no small force of infantry and cavalry as well. Once his whole force was gathered at Ptolemais, he handed part of it over to his son and to one of his friends and sent them to make war on the Galileans, who lived near Ptolemais. This force attacked, routed those who took a stand against it in battle, took Sepphoris, enslaved its inhabitants, and burned the city. Verus himself advanced with the whole army toward Samaria, but spared the city itself because it had taken no part in the disturbances, and camped instead at a village belonging to Ptolemy called Arus. The Arabs, out of hatred for Herod, burned this village, showing hostility even to those who were his friends. From there they advanced, and the Arabs plundered and burned another village, Sampho, which was very strongly fortified, and nothing escaped them on their march. Everything was filled with fire and slaughter. Emmaus, too, was burned at the order of Verus in retaliation for those who had been killed there, after its inhabitants had fled ahead of him. From there he advanced and now drew near to Jerusalem, and the Jews who had been besieging the legion, camped there, could not bear the sight of the approaching army and fled, abandoning the siege half finished. The Jews within Jerusalem, when Verus sharply charged them, cleared themselves of the accusations, saying that the crowd had gathered only for the festival, and that the war had not been of their own choosing at all, but that they had been drawn into it, and had been besieged themselves along with the Romans through the boldness of the newcomers, and had shown more eagerness to help the siege against them than to besiege anyone. Josephus, a cousin of King Herod, together with Gratus and Rufus, came out ahead to meet Verus, bringing the soldiers under their command, along with the Romans who had been under siege. Sabinus did not come into Verus's presence at all, but slipped out of the city and made for the coast. Verus then sent part of his army through the country in search of those responsible for the revolt. When they were identified, he punished the most guilty, but let some go free. Those crucified for this cause came to 2,000. After this, he sent his own army back home, seeing that it was of no use for anything in the present business. Much of it had grown undisciplined and had disregarded Verus's own orders in its pursuit of the gains that came from wrongdoing. He himself, learning that 10,000 Jews had banded together, hurried to capture them. But they did not come to blows at all. Instead, they surrendered themselves at the advice of Aeshub. Verus, granting the crowd a pardon, sent to Caesar those who had been their leaders in the revolt. Caesar let most of them go free, but punished only those who, though relatives of Herod, had campaigned with the rebels, since they had shown no regard for what was right in taking up arms against their own kin. Having settled these matters and left the legion that had been there before to garrison Jerusalem, Varus hurried back to Antioch. For Archelaus, meanwhile, new troubles were beginning to grow at Rome for the following reasons. A delegation of Jews arrived at Rome, since Varus had permitted their nation to send envoys to request self-rule. Those sent as envoys by decision of the nation were 50 in number, and they were supported by more than 8,000 of the Jews then living at Rome. Caesar gathered a council of his own friends and of the leading Romans in the Temple of Apollo, which he had built at great expense, and the envoys arrived together with the crowd of Jews resident there, while Archelaus came with his friends. Whichever of the king's relatives, there were held back from siding with Archelaus out of hatred for him, yet they thought it a dreadful thing to vote with the envoys against him, believing it would bring shame on themselves in Caesar's eyes to show themselves so eager to act in this way against one of their own family. Philip, too, was now present, having come from Syria at Varus's urging, chiefly so as to plead his brother's case. For Varus was very well disposed toward him, and since a change was coming over the kingdom, Varus suspected that it would be divided up, on account of the many who were eager for self-rule, and he did not want to be too late to secure some share of it for Philip himself as well. When the floor was given to the Jewish envoys, who had hoped to speak in favor of abolishing the kingdom altogether, they turned instead to accusing Herod of his lawless acts, declaring that though he had borne the name of king, he had in fact taken on himself the full measure of ruthlessness found in every tyranny, combining it all for the destruction of the Jews, and that it was simply his nature never to stop devising fresh evils. Indeed, of the many who had perished in utter ruin, no one before could recall the like, and far more wretched than those who had died were those still living, since they suffered not only in what grieved the eye and the mind, but also in their very property. He had adorned the neighboring cities, inhabited by foreigners, at the expense of destroying and laying waste the cities of his own realm, and he had reduced a nation that had received only modest prosperity to the depths of poverty. Whenever he put the nobility to death on groundless charges, he confiscated their estates, and those to whom he granted the wretchedness of mere survival he condemned to be stripped of their property. And apart from the taxes imposed each year on everyone, there were separate exactions paid to him, his household, his friends, and those of his slaves who went out to collect the taxes, because it was impossible to secure anything without paying, however unjustly demanded, in silver. As for the violation of virgins and the shaming of wives, done in drunken outrage and simple human depravity, they would stay silent, since it gave those who suffered it as much relief to keep it unknown as it would have to have it never happen at all. Such was the outrage Herod visited upon them, of a kind no wild beast would inflict were it granted power over men. Indeed, though the nation had passed through many upheavals and changes, none could recall a disaster of this kind ever having befallen it before, so that Herod himself stood as the very model of the ill-treatment he inflicted on the nation. It would only be natural, then, that Archelaus should gladly be hailed as king in the expectation that whoever succeeded to the throne would prove more moderate than Herod, and that he would join his subjects in mourning his father, so as to win at least a measure of moderation, and would grow close to them in every other way as well. But since Archelaus feared he would not be believed the true son of Herod, he had, without any delay, straightway shown the nation his true character. And this before he had even fully secured his rule, since that lay with Caesar to grant and was not yet in his power, by making a slaughter of 3,000 of his fellow citizens in the temple itself, as an example of the virtue he would show his future subjects in moderation and good government. An offering made both to his countrymen and to God from the very first act he displayed in office. How could such men not now be entitled to a just hatred against him, in addition to his other cruelty, and to bring the charge of resistance and opposition to his rule as a further complaint? The sum of their request was to be freed from kingship and from rule of that kind altogether, and instead, becoming an addition to the province of Syria, to be placed under the governors sent out there. For in that way it would become clear whether they truly were rebellious and much given to revolution, or not, once they came under more moderate men set to govern them. When the Jews had spoken to this effect, Nicolaus cleared the kings of the charges, defending Herod on the ground that during his lifetime he had gone unaccused. For surely those who had grounds for complaint against a living man, who was able to punish them for moderate offenses, ought not to bring their accusation together only against a dead man. As for what had been done by Archelaus, he laid the blame on the outrage of the Jews themselves, who, in reaching for things contrary to the laws and beginning the slaughter, brought the charge against those who had merely defended themselves against their violence once they acted. He accused them further of a love of revolution and sedition, born of an undisciplined refusal to submit to justice, and the laws, out of a desire to have everything their own way in all things. This, then, was what Nicolaus said. Caesar, having heard them, dissolved the council, but a few days later he did not declare Archelaus king. Instead, he made him ethnarch of half the territory that had paid tribute to Herod, promising to honor him with the rank of king if he conducted himself in a manner worthy of it. The other half he divided in two and gave over to two of Herod's other sons, Philip and Antipas, the same Antipas who had disputed with his brother Archelaus over the whole realm. To Antipas were made subject Perea and Galilee, with a tribute of 200 talents a year. Batania, together with Trachonitis and Oronitis, along with part of the house of Zenodorus, as it was called, paid Philip 100 talents. What was subject to Archelaus included Idumea, Judea, and the Samaritan territory, though the last had a quarter of its tribute remitted, Caesar having voted them this relief because they had not joined the rest of the people in revolt. The cities subject to Archelaus were Strato's Tower and Sebaste along with Joppa and Jerusalem. For Gaza, Gadara, and Hippos, being Greek cities, Caesar detached from his jurisdiction, he added this to the province of Syria. The revenue in money that came to Archelaus each year from the territory he had received amounted to 600 talents. Such were the shares that fell to the sons of Herod from their father's estate. As for Salome, besides what her brother assigned her in his will, Jamnia, Azotus, and Phasaelis, and 500,000 drachmas of coined silver, Caesar granted her also the royal residence at Ascalon. This too brought in a revenue of 60 talents a year, and its estate lay within the territory of Archelaus. The rest of the king's relatives received whatever the will had specified for them. To Herod's two unmarried daughters, apart from what their father had left them, Caesar gave a dowry of 250,000 drachmas of coined silver each, and married them to the sons of Pheroras. He also granted to the king's children whatever Herod had left to him personally, some 1,500 talents, keeping back only a few pieces of furniture, valued not for their worth, but because they reminded him of the king who had given them. While these matters were being settled by Caesar, a young man, Jewish by birth but raised in the city of Sidon in the household of a Roman freedman, made his way into Herod's family circle by trading on a resemblance of build to Alexander, Herod's murdered son, which struck all who saw him. This encouraged him to make a bid for the throne. Taking as his accomplice a countryman of his who was experienced in the affairs of the court, naturally villainous and capable of stirring up great trouble, and who now became his tutor in this kind of wickedness, he gave himself out to be Alexander, Herod's son, smuggled away by the men sent to kill him. For, he said, they had killed others in his place to deceive onlookers, and had spared both him and his brother Aristobulus. Buoyed up by this story, he did not stop deceiving those he met, but crossing to Crete, he won over to belief in him every Jew he came in contact with there, and having got money from their generosity, he sailed on to Melos. There he received far more money still, on the strength of his royal kinship, and in the hope of recovering his ancestral throne and rewarding his benefactors. He hurried on to Rome escorted by his private hosts, and putting in at Puteoli, he had no less success in winning over the Jews there by the same deception. They came flocking to him as to a king, both the rest and all who had had ties of hospitality and friendship with Herod. The reason lay in people's readiness to believe gladly what they were told, reinforced by the convincing likeness of his features. For even those who had been closely acquainted with Alexander were largely persuaded that he was no other than Alexander himself, and they swore to their neighbors that it was so, so that when word of him spread through Rome, the whole Jewish community there went out to meet him, hailing this unhoped-for deliverance as an act of God and rejoicing on account of his descent through his mother, whenever he passed down the street carried in a litter. Everything about him had a royal air, kept up at the expense of his private hosts. Great crowds gathered around him with cries of acclamation such as naturally attend men so unexpectedly restored. There was nothing that was not done for him. When the report about him reached Caesar, he was inclined to disbelieve it, since he did not think Herod could easily have been deceived in matters that concerned him so greatly. Still, giving some room to hope, he sent Cellatus, one of his own freedmen who had been acquainted with the young princes, with orders to bring Alexander before him. Cellatus brought the man, who proved no better able to withstand the judgment of a discerning eye than he had been to withstand that of the crowd. Caesar indeed was not deceived. The man did resemble Alexander, but not so closely as to fool those capable of sober judgment. His hands were worn from manual labor, and instead of the softness that came from Alexander's pampered, well-born constitution, his body, shaped by the opposite way of life, had turned out coarser. Observing this collusion between teacher and pupil in their lying story, and the boldness with which they had put it together, Caesar questioned him about Aristobulus. What had become of him, since he had supposedly been smuggled away with him, and why he had not come forward too, to claim the rank that men of such birth were entitled to. The man replied that Aristobulus had been left behind on Cyprus for fear of the dangers of the sea, so that if some disaster befell the one of them, the line of Mariam might not be wiped out entirely, but Aristobulus might survive to deal with those who had plotted against them. While he was still insisting on this, with the deviser of the whole scheme backing him up, Caesar took the young man aside privately and said, "A reward awaits you if you will not try to deceive me as well, on condition that your life is spared. Tell me truly who you really are, and who put you up to daring such a scheme, for the plot you have undertaken shows more cunning than your years would suggest." And so, since there was no other course open to him, he told Caesar the whole plot, how it had been arranged and by whom. Caesar did not punish the false Alexander, for he had not lied once he confessed the truth to him, but, seeing that he was strong enough to work with his hands, assigned him to row among the oarsmen. The man who had put him up to it, he had put to death. As for the people of Melos, their loss of everything they had spent on the false Alexander was penalty enough. Such was the inglorious end of this bold conspiracy concerning the false Alexander. Archelaus, once he had taken over the ethnarchy and arrived in Judea, removed Josar son of Bothus from the high priesthood, holding against him his support of the rebels, and put in his place Josar's brother Eleazar. He also rebuilt the palace at Jericho magnificently, and diverted half the water that irrigated the village of Nera to supply the plain he had planted with palm trees, and founded a village there which he named Archelae after himself. In violation of ancestral custom, he married Glaphyra, daughter of King Archelaus, and formerly the wife of his own brother Alexander, by whom she had had children, though it was forbidden among the Jews for a man to marry his brother's widow. Nor did Eleazar remain long in the priesthood, for while he was still alive, he was replaced by Jesus son of Si. In the 10th year of Archelaus's rule, the leading men among the Jews and Samaritans, no longer able to bear his cruelty and tyranny, brought accusations against him before Caesar, especially since they had learned that he had disregarded the instructions given him to treat his subjects with moderation. When Caesar heard this, he angrily summoned Archelaus's agent in Rome. His name too was Archelaus, and considered it beneath him to write to Archelaus himself, but told the agent, "Sail at once, without any delay, and bring him back to us." The man made a swift crossing, and on reaching Judea found Archelaus feasting with his friends. He informed him of Caesar's decision and urged him to set out at once. Caesar, when Archelaus arrived, gave a hearing to his accusers and then to his own defense, and sent him into exile, assigning him Vienne, a city in Gaul, as his place of residence, while confiscating his property. Before he was summoned to Rome, Archelaus had described to his friends a dream he had had. He seemed to see 10 ears of wheat, full grown and heavy with grain, being devoured by oxen. On waking, since the vision seemed to portend something momentous, he sent for the interpreters of dreams who made such matters their study. While they gave conflicting explanations, one to another, for no single account satisfied them all, a man of the Essene sect named Simon, after asking leave to speak freely, said that the vision foretold a change of fortune for Archelaus, and not for the better. Oxen, he explained, signified hardship, since the animal labors at its work, and further signified change, because ground plowed by their toil cannot remain in the same state. While the 10 ears of grain marked out a like number of years, since one ear comes to harvest in the course of a single year, and Archelaus's time in power was drawing to its end. So he interpreted the dream. On the 5th day after this vision first came to him, the man Archelaus who had been summoned, the other one, arrived in Judea to bring him back. Something similar befell his wife Glaphyra as well, daughter of King Archelaus, to whom, as I said earlier, Alexander, son of Herod and brother of Archelaus, had been married when she was a virgin. When it happened that Alexander was put to death by his father, she was married to Juba, king of the Libyans, and after the Libyans' death, while she was living as a widow in Cappadocia with her father, Archelaus took her as his wife, divorcing his own wife Mariam to do so, so great was his passion for Glaphyra. While living with Archelaus, she had the following dream. She seemed to see Alexander appear before her, and rejoiced at the sight and embraced him eagerly, but he reproached her, saying, "Glaphyra, you prove true the saying that women cannot be trusted, you who pledged yourself to me and shared my home as a virgin, and yet, though we had children together, have consigned my love to oblivion out of desire for a second marriage. And not content with that outrage, you have dared to take a third husband into your bed as well, coming shamelessly and improperly into my house, and contracting a marriage with Archelaus, a man who is your own brother-in-law and my brother. But I will not forget my affection for you. Instead, I will free you from every reproach, restoring you to what you were as I had made you." Having told this to the women who were her companions, she died within a few days. I have thought it worth recounting these matters, not regarding them as foreign to the present history, both because it concerns the royal family, and, further, because it affords an example bearing on the immortality of souls and on how divine providence embraces human affairs. Whoever finds such things hard to believe is free to keep his own opinion, without hindering another who is led by them toward virtue. When the territory of Archelaus had been added as a dependency to that of Syria, Caesar sent Quirinius, a man of consular rank, to assess property values in Syria and to sell off the estate of Archelaus.